So let's do a bit of structure then. Most of you would know that originally it's not 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. You know that it's one book. So it's the book of Samuel. So we have, our translators have divided it into 2 books. And that's not always a good idea. So always bear in mind that it's one book in the original Hebrew Bible. And what we have in 1 Samuel, we have 3 stories. You've got the story of Samuel, the story of Saul, and then you've got the story of David. Okay, so those 3 stories find themselves in 1 Samuel, and then in 2 Samuel, you have the story of David. But it's David part 2. Now, in 1 Samuel, you've got 3 divisions. You'd expect that, wouldn't you? You've got 3 men, 3 characters, and each section has a division, if you like. And there are verses that summarize each of the divisions. So you all still with me so far? 3 sections, 3 men, and once you finish the story of Samuel, you get verses that are like a summary. You get the story of Saul, you get a summary. And then really, it goes into 2 Samuel, where you get the summary of David. Let me see if I can point this out a little bit better than that. So go to 1 Samuel chapter 7, and this is where the first section ends, and you get a summary. So 1 Samuel chapter 7, and look at the end of the chapter. Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. He went from year to year on a circuit to Bethel, Gilgal, Mizpah, and judged Israel in all those places. But he always returned to Ramah, but his home was there. And there he judged Israel, and there he built an altar to the Lord. Now that's Samuel's section. So from chapter 1 to chapter 7, that's all Samuel, and you get those lovely verses that sum everything up. What we've read tonight then, in chapter 14, is the summary of Saul. So Saul's story is chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10, all the way to chapter 14, and you get the summary at the end. So we've just read the summary, verse 47 to verse 52 of chapter 14, verse 47. So Saul established his sovereignty over Israel. Okay, so there's Saul's section, chapter 8 to chapter 14. What now happens in chapter 15 is we get the David section. Okay, so from chapter 15 right into 2 Samuel is the story of David. Now, those are your 3 sections. And you're all going to say to me, but Neil, in chapter 15, who do we find? Who's this chapter about? Saul. What do you mean it's about David? Well, it's actually the story of David, starts in chapter 15, against the background of Saul. So whilst in chapter 15 you get all this initial detail on Saul, is just to prepare you for the story of David. So that's the sections then, okay? Now, as you look at chapter 14 and the summary of Saul, what should shock you as you read these summary verses? Think back to all that we've learned. We've seen the people demanding a king. God chooses Saul because he's head and shoulders above everybody else. Do you remember on the day that he was to be revealed, he was hiding amongst the farm equipment? Do you remember when he went looking for the donkeys? It wasn't Saul who had the bright ideas, it was his servant. Do you remember what Saul has been like when we looked at him last Sunday night? Those 3 stories of Saul's stupidity and Jonathan's wisdom, Saul's cowardice, Jonathan's courage. You know, you've got all that about Saul. And then when you come to verses 47 to 52, what stands out? What's surprising? It's a successful summary, isn't it? Do you see that? Look at the summary again. Saul, verse 47, Saul established his sovereignty over Israel. He fought against his enemies. He gathered an army. He attacked the Amalekites. Verse 48, he delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. It's a very positive summary of Saul. So how can we have a positive summary of Saul when we have just spent all these weeks looking at his weakness, his rashness, his cowardice? Remember, he sits under the pomegranate tree with 300 followers, and Jonathan's the one who goes off and fights the Philistines. And then Saul takes the credit. And then that day last week, we saw it when Jonathan goes up against the Philistines. Saul comes along and he says, right, we're going to kill them all today, and nobody's to eat anything until today is over. And do you remember, the people start to faint and they're hungry and they're weak. And Jonathan comes along and he says, I'm stupid, let me eat that honey. And Jonathan eats the honey. And Saul says, it's your fault that we can't beat these Philistines. Let's kill Jonathan. Now, here's all this detail about Saul. And then you've got a summary right at the end. He delivered Israel. He gathered an army. He attacked his enemies. Do you all see that, first of all? And with these glasses, I can't see you very well, so you have to nod vigorously. Do we see it? It's a terrible story. And then you've got this lovely summary at the end. And you think, how is that? How can we have such a positive description of Saul when we've just spent all these chapters seeing his failures? And his greatest failure, do you remember what it was? Saul's greatest failure? He was to wait 7 days before Samuel came to bring him the word of God. Do you remember? And there's Saul waiting, and he gets to the seventh day, and it's the morning, and Samuel doesn't come. And he gets to lunchtime, and Samuel doesn't come. And he's surrounded by his enemies, and his soldiers have been deserting. And so Saul decides that he can't wait any longer for Samuel. He gives the sacrifice. And as soon as he finishes, do you remember? As soon as he finishes the sacrifice, he turns, and coming up the hill is Samuel. And Samuel announces to Saul, God has rejected you because you disobedient. You didn't wait 7 days. And Saul begins to make excuses. Well, I was waiting, and this is the seventh day, and you were late. And do you remember how we saw back then that Saul did the function of a priest offering a sacrifice? But what's more important than priestly religion? What does Samuel symbolize? The prophet? The word of God. Much more important than trying to get God's favor by being a priest. So from that moment on, Saul's descendants are rejected. He won't have a son to be on the throne, even though Jonathan's so wonderful. And Samuel says, you won't have the word of God either, Saul. Now, this is Saul for you, okay? This guy, this tragic figure. And then, just to drive the point home, come to this summary and look at how wonderful he is. Have I made that clear? You've got the disasters, you've got the stupidity, the rashness, the cowardice, the foolishness of Saul. He's been rejected then. He's got the most perfect son who would be the best king. But no, his house is going to end with him. And then the summary, verse 48. He delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. So whoever writes this, and we don't know who writes Samuel, wants you to stop and think, come on, what's going on here? How do we explain this positive summary of this man when you've just painted him in such black characters? And that's what we're going to do. We're going to try and solve the problem. So if you already know what the problem is, score past six, tell us, we can go on. Okay? How do we solve this thing? And the way that you try to approach this is you say there are two points of view. From the one point of view, Saul is a great success. But from the other point of view, Saul is a failure. And you have to work out, what points of view are we talking about? And once you work out these two points of view, you've got your lesson for the day. You've got your Bible lesson. So turning to the summary then, verse 47 to verse 52 in chapter 14, he established his sovereignty, verse 47, and each of the verses sets out for you his successfulness. He established his sovereignty. So that is, he became king. He was recognized and regarded and treated as king. His authority was established. Verse 48, he gathered this army. So remember now, he's only had 300 or 600 people so far. He gathers an army. He attacks. Now, we've seen him as a guy who sits under the trees and does nothing. He attacks the Amalekites. He delivers Israel. And then verse 49. How is verse 49 and verse 50 and so on? How are they successes? Think of what I've said to you so far. So verse 49, the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Jishui and Malchishua. And he had two daughters, Merab and Michael. Look at him, he's successful. Was he successful in producing?
Descendants.
Future kings. He's pretty successful. If you think about our royal family, what do they always want to make sure they have? An A.
And a spear.
And a spear. Well, gosh, Saul has got an A and two spears. And he's got two daughters. What can a king do with two daughters?
Well, Michael marries David.
That's right. So what can you do with daughters? Mm-hmm. Marry them off to other royal families. So he's been successful then in being able to get A's and spares and establish his line. And then you go down, he's got a wife. Mm-hmm. And he's got a commander of the army who's the son of Saul's uncle. So what does that make, Abner? If you're the son of your uncle,
cousin.
Is it cousin? First cousin? Yeah, so he's got a first cousin leading the army. So if you've got a first cousin who's leading the army, what's the army not likely to do? Rebel against you as king. So you've got your family in the armed forces in charge of them, all these lovely offspring to carry your name forward. You've got a wife who's the daughter of Ahimaaz. Now, we've lost the significance of that. And then Kish is the father of Saul. Ner's the father of Abner. It's all a family matter. And then the last verse, there's a fierce war with the Philistines all the days of Saul. But what was Saul so good at? Listen. When Saul saw any strong man or valiant man, he added to his army. What's he good at? If you put it in today's language, you've got to make sure you put lots of money away in your defences. You've got to get a good defence policy. Build up your armed forces because you've got a constant enemy. Who's the constant enemy? The Philistines. So if you've got a constant enemy, very much like Israel now, whatever you think of what's going on now, Israel is surrounded by enemies. David builds up his armies. So what a good chap. How good he is. How well he's done. So, from one point of view, Saul does really well. And then from the other point of view, he doesn't. So what are the two points of view? So I've given you the clues really in the notice sheet. From the point of view of what does Saul do really well?
Establishing the nation.
Think of a point of view. A point of view. Kingship. So you could do a kingship, or if you wanted to be even broader, Richard, so that we can apply this same idea to ourselves. From a human point of view, or if you like, from the point of view of history, from a secular point of view, from the point of view of this life. From the point of view of the one that we all share, he's a success from that point of view. From what point of view is he a failure? And it's the obvious answer. From God's point of view. And that's the main lesson here. Any person, Saul, me, you, our families, from one point of view, their lives might look like successes, but from another point of view, their life might be one of rejection. And I think this lesson of two points of view is very important. Because if we think of, let's start with our families, and we look at our children or our grandchildren, and as we look at them, from our point of view, how are their lives going? When we look at their jobs, their houses, their kids, what would we say about them? That they've done really well. And we're proud of them. And we rejoice in them. And that's like the summary of Saul. We could say, my son married this girl, and he had this house, and he got this job, and he had this car. That's that summary for you in chapter 14. It's a summary of achievements. It's a summary of priorities. You're summarizing the life of that person. And from that point of view, really good. But from the point of view of God, what's God's view? What would God's judgment be? And you see that that's the lesson here. We've had chapter after chapter of God's point of view, and then it's all summarized from a historical point of view. So from a man of history, if you ask the people, it would be, well done, Saul. If you wrote a book about him, it would be, look at this man's achievements. But from the point of view of God, he's rejected. And which point of view, as we've said, which point of view matters? God's. And I think this is quite difficult, because in our conversations with each other, when we talk about our families, we talk about the point of view that's, what should we call it? Human?
Secular.
Secular. Ordinary. From that point of view, when we talk about our families, we are talking about their latest this and their greatest that, and what they've done now, and what school. And that's how we talk together, don't we, when we talk about our families? So we can use that one, if you like. It can be worldly, secular, ordinary. And we have, you know, we're not saying that either is, you know, history is false. Saul did all these things. He built his army. He delivered Israel. So it's all right that we talk about things from this point of view, and we say, do you know what my granddaughter's done this weekend? And do you know what they've achieved this weekend? We do all that, don't we? But we sometimes need to hold in our minds, what's the judgment of God? What's his point of view? How does he see it? What's his verdict? And I feel at times that what we should be doing, I hate the word should, so delete that from the record. Not should, because we don't do rules, but sometimes I wonder whether we, better word than should?
Useful to.
It would be, well done, Richard, I thought I might say we ought, and that's just as bad as should. It would be good if we could bring in God's viewpoint into our family lives. And it fits in, and Lynette very kindly at the beginning of the year wrote out our priority verses. It fits into one of them. Remember those four verses that we said we need to keep in mind at all times? What shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? You know, if our kids become presidents and prime ministers and millionaires, what does it profit them? If they get all that, and then they lose their own soul. And that's what these judgment verses are about. Saul got all that profit. But what good did it do him? Because he lost his own soul. Now, that's the idea. So let's build on this a little bit. And I'm going to say something that you may feel is a bit bizarre. There's a website that you can go on to. That's called the Ship of Fools. Now, you all don't do it now, but you might go back home, and if you use the internet, you might try it out. And on this website, it's a religious website, there's a particular link that you can follow called the Mystery Worshipper. And apparently, people go around churches as a mystery worshipper, like a mystery shopper. And they go into the church and they start rating everything. How comfortable are the pews? How nice was the welcome? What was the singing like? What was the sermon like? And they have to put down how long the sermon was, And how do you rate it out of 10? And then you have to say, what was the after service like? Did you have coffee? Was it instant? Or was it nice stuff that you get, you know, in Costa coffee? Were there biscuits? Were people friendly? And as you go through this sort of checklist, the last two questions are these. Did going there on Sunday make you glad to be a Christian? And then the last one is, was any of your time in church today a bit like the other place? And what do they mean by the other place? Hell. Was anything like hell about it? Kids crying, uncomfortable seats. Now, can you see that mystery worshipper page? And it's hundreds of churches have been visited. Churches in Wales have been visited, the United States, right around the world. And this person comes in and makes all these judgments about us. Does it matter what anybody judges us to be? Does human judgment matter? What is it in the minds of people like that who think they can sit in judgment on the people of God, worshipping God? Did the music make you happy? Was it traditional and boring? We judge, don't we? There's this idea of judgment. And even that idea of judgment has come into the church, whereby we think we can judge the worship, the service, the building, the people. And this passage is telling us that from one point of view, human judgment, things might look good or things might look bad. But which judgment matters? God's. And it's God's judgment about our worship. What does God think about how we worship on Sunday? Do we worship him in a way that pleases him? Are we honouring him and glorifying him? You know, we've had some visitors recently, haven't we? And I don't know if these thoughts ever darken your minds. They do mine. What do they think of us when they come in? Especially when they visit and then they don't come back. Oh dear, what do they think of us? And it's a passage like this helps us to recognise that the only judgment that matters is God's. And are we pleasing him? And does he rejoice in what we do and how we do it? So there's always these two choices to make when we look at our kids and our grandchildren. Do we judge them by, what is it again? Human, secular, ordinary standards? Or do we bear in mind, what's God's judgment there? Ourselves, as a congregation, we're getting older, we're getting fewer. Judgment, always making judgments. Anybody do the take-home from last week? What did Jonathan say to his armor bearer when they go up against the Philistines? Nothing restrains God from saving by many or by few. And David, you've said it this week, numbers don't matter. I'm sure you've said it to me at some point this week. Numbers don't matter. So we don't need human judgment. So let's apply this one last way. One of the things that we often do is we judge ourselves. And we can judge ourselves from two points of view. We can judge ourselves from the secular, the ordinary, the worldly point of view. Have I done well? Have I been a success? Or we judge ourselves from whose point of view? God's. And what's God's judgment on us? God's judgment on Saul was that he rejected him. Because God said, you were not a man after my heart. So Saul was rejected by God. That was God's judgment. So he was to stay king until the end of his days, but his house would end. Now, what's God's judgment on you? Now, when I say that to you now, okay, what's the first thought that comes to mind? What's God's judgment of you? Now, you haven't got to tell me your first thought. These are inside thoughts. But what comes to mind when I say the only judgment that matters about you and me is God's? Certain words will come into your mind. And until these words come in automatically to our minds, we've still got a lot to learn. What are the words that should come automatically into your mind when you ask the question, what's God's judgment on me?
Justified.
Yes, that's not so much a word, Richard, that's more of a theological position. But you're right. Think of words that Jesus used when he was talking about what's God's judgments on us. And he gave those parables. He used words. Okay, he used a formula. And he says, on that day, remember the day when he will separate the sheep from the goats, the wheat from the tares. He will say, he will bring his people to his father. And my father will say, well done, my good and faithful servant. That's God's judgment on you. So when I ask you, what's God's judgment on you? Unless that thought comes in, he'll say, well done. That's what he'll say. We've got a lot still to learn, okay? God's judgment is, well done, my good and faithful servant. And that's the only judgment that matters about us. Doesn't matter my judgment of myself. Doesn't matter your judgment of me. One of the things that I've always found very difficult about being a minister, so much so that I don't do it anymore, is going to ministers' conferences. I mean, if you ever want an afternoon of utter misery, go to a minister's conference. Because you all turn up and you listen to some poor minister who has to be a big name, by the way. You know, we're all ministers, we all preach, but no, let's get somebody you really fancy. And then you listen to the guy preach, and what does every single minister then do? Judge. Oh, I thought he was really good. No, I thought he got it wrong. And you get that judgment. It doesn't matter what people think of you. Doesn't matter how they judge your preaching, how they judge other things. Doesn't matter. The only judgment that matters is God's. And so there's a New Testament equivalent of all this teaching. And it's no surprise if I tell you it's the Apostle Paul. And we can work it out. We can get there without me telling you if I kind of give you a helping hand. Which church that it was involved with Paul, did he have the most trouble with?
Corinthians.
And the Corinthian church, what did they do with Paul? What did they keep on doing? What's our theme? Judging. They kept judging Paul. What did they say about his preaching? Do you remember what they said about his preaching? That his preaching was always about the cross. It was lacking in the wisdom of this world. His preaching wasn't sophisticated. What did they say about his physical appearance? Do you remember? Poor old Paul. He was short and he was squinting. Hey, did he cut an impressive figure? No. Did he look dynamic? No. Who did they prefer to the Apostle Paul? I am of Paul. I am of Cephas. I am of Apollos. Okay? And some who were really good at judging said, oh, well, we are of Jesus. You know, we're above you all. We are. You know, we're super duper spiritual. We are. So, which letter am I in? There's only two to choose from. Is it 1 or 2 Corinthians? Come on, there's no right or wrong, guys. I'm not going to judge now if anybody gets the wrong one. We're in 1 Corinthians. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, this is what Paul says. Let a man consider me then as a servant of Christ and stewards of the mystery of God. Moreover, there's only one thing required of a steward, and that is to be found faithful. Now, with me, it's a very small thing that I should be judged by any of you, or that I should be judged by anyone. And here he goes, you ready now? I do not even judge myself. 1 Corinthians 4. For I know nothing against myself, but I'm not justified by this, but he who judges me is the Lord. Therefore, judge no one before the time, until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the hidden things of darkness and reveal the counsels of the hearts. Then each one's praise will come from God. And that's all that matters. What's God's judgment of me and you? And don't judge until then. Hold back until then. And then each one's judgment shall come from the Lord. He who judges me is the Lord. And then each one's praise will come from God. Now that's the lesson for tonight, everyone. Okay, you've got one standard by which we judge people and leaders and kings and fathers and husbands. We judge them all by this one standard, but the only judgment that matters is God. That's about the great figures of history. I love history. And we judge who's the best prime minister we've ever had, or who's the greatest king we've ever had. Our judgments, they don't matter. The only one that matters is God's. And that's about us as a congregation. It's about us as individuals. It's about the fact that God, in his time, his verdict will come, and his verdict is well done, my good and faithful servant. And I'm going to leave this with you. How do we get to that place when we only care about God's judgment? How do we get there? Because I think we're still very much caught up with other people's judgments of us. And we're caught up with our judgments of ourselves. How can we get to that place where the only judgment that matters is God's? And this is a very practical subject, and I won't go into practical details because I know things can be sensitive here. But if we do free ourselves from the need of making judgments all the time, then I think we've made a great, great progress. So come back to 1 Corinthians 14, and the answer to how do we get there so that the only judgment that matters is God's, Paul actually gives you the steps in these verses. So I'll just read them again, and I won't point out the steps, but there are two of these verses that set out the steps for you that you can take, and the end result is that you only worry now about God's judgment. So let me read the verses again. See if you can identify the two verses, and then take a look at them. So let a man consider me as a servant of Christ and a steward of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found faithful. Now with me, clear there. This is the verse then. Now with me, how did I get you? With me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human judgment. In fact, he says, I do not even judge myself. Verse 4. So the two verses are 3 and 4. For I know nothing against myself, yet I'm not justified by this. But he who judges me is the Lord, and so on. Okay, therefore, verse 5, judge nothing before the time. So you can see, can't you, that in those verses, when he talks about I, those are the verses to focus in on. I should be judged by you. I do not judge myself. I know nothing of myself. If you want to know how to get there, look at those uses of the word I. Paul's telling you what he's learned, how he's learned it. So look at those three verses 3 and 4. Think about them, and Paul sets down three steps that helps you. And if we can take each one, then we may then feel liberated from the fear of anybody else's judgment. Let's pray, shall we?